This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Nearly 4 weeks into the war in Sudan broke out, there are no indications the warring factions have any intentions of negotiating an end as fighting rages on. VOA's correspondent, Africa correspondent, Miriama Diallo, has a report from Nairobi.
25 days since the war in Sudan broke out, there are no indications the warring factions have any intentions of negotiating an end as fighting rages on. Representatives from the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces have been meeting in the Saudi city of Jeddah. The ongoing conflict has created an exodus to many neighboring countries, including South Sudan, where many left a few years ago when that country also experienced a civil war. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Joe Biden and congressional leaders have agreed to meet again to try to avert the looming risk of unprecedented American debt default.
President says default is not an option and will not happen.
I'm absolutely certain.
Calling a meeting with Congress's top leaders productive. But House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says everyone was dug in.
I didn't see any new movement.
And time is running short, with the government unable to pay all its bills as soon as June 1st if the debt ceiling is not raised. McCarthy's insisting the president agree to sweeping spending cuts in exchange for boosting the ceiling. The president says he's happy to talk,
but not under the threat of default.
The speaker says he asked a simple question.
Does he not believe there's any place we could find savings?
The president says they will all meet again Friday in a further bid to avoid the nation's first ever debt default. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
This is VOA News. It appears to be the end of an era for a malicious Russian malware program. VOA's Steve Herman explains.
The FBI on Tuesday revealed it has neutralized a malware network used for two decades by Russia to spy in 50 countries. Government cybersecurity officials in the United States say the snake was defanged by the FBI, describing the malware as the most sophisticated cyber espionage tool in the arsenal of Russia's intelligence services. It wormed its way for many years, authorities say, into computer systems of governments, research facilities, banks, news media, and other organizations around the world. Computer security experts have known about the malware for years, but it was hard to detect in computer systems and network traffic.
That is VOA Steve Herman reporting. It appears a jury has found Donald Trump liable for sexually abusing Advice columnist E. Jean Carroll in 1996. Jurors awarded her $5 million in a judgment that could haunt the former president as he campaigns to regain the White House. The verdict was announced in a federal courtroom in New York City on the first day of deliberations. Jurors rejected Carroll's claim that she was raped, but found Trump liable for sexual abuse and for defaming Carroll after she made her allegations public. Trump chose not to attend the civil trial and was absent when the verdict was read. The Christian Association of Nigeria says it's still searching for 20 people abducted by gunmen from a church during a Sunday service. VOA's Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Kaduna State Chair of the Christian Association of Nigeria Tuesday said about 42 people were in the church on Sunday morning before the attackers invaded and took all the worshippers away, including women and children. He said the bandits later released 22 of them and have been holding the remaining 20. Armed gangs known locally as bandits have been carrying out kidnap for ransom raids in northern Nigeria for years. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Discord is a social app favored by gamers, but it has stirred internal strife after announcing last week that it will force its millions of members to pick new usernames. It may sound trivial, but it's a big deal for people who rely on the mid-sized network to recruit fellow gamers, swap virtual weapons, and organize strategy in multiplayer games. The users have long been free to choose any name they wanted, even ones already in use. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
jury reaches a fast verdict in the civil rape case against former U.S. President Donald Trump.
On his social media site, Donald Trump called the verdict a disgrace and a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time.
Plus, as truce talks yield no progress, the exodus and death toll in Sudan continues to increase.
And unfortunately, the continuous ceasefire announcement that we hear is just ridiculous. It's not happening.
And when it comes to Americans and their dogs, the most popular breed at the moment is small on size and big on personality. Today is Tuesday, May 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. Deliberating on whether Donald Trump raped writer E. Jean Carroll more than two decades ago and then defamed her, a federal jury reached a verdict Tuesday in just 3 hours. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue has details.
A jury in New York found former President Donald Trump liable for sexually abusing Advice columnist E. Jean Carroll in 1996. Jurors rejected the claim by Carroll Trump raped her, but liable for sexual abuse and for defaming Carroll after she made her allegations public. He was ordered to pay $5 million. Carroll did not speak after leaving court. Trump attorney Joe Tacopina says they will appeal.
Part of me was obviously very happy that Donald Trump was not granted a rapist. I didn't think there should be any liability findings, so we'll pursue it.
Tacopina was asked if this will derail Trump's presidential campaign.
Nope.
On his social media site, Donald Trump called the verdict a disgrace and a continuation of the greatest witch hunt of all time. I'm Ed Donahue.
Russia fired cruise missiles Tuesday at Kyiv while parading troops across Red Square in an event celebrating the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters that Russian President Vladimir Putin sent the wrong message.
Victory Day is supposed to be about peace and unity in Europe. It's supposed to be about the end of war and bloodshed and suffering. Instead, Mr. Putin promised only more violence and spewed only more lies about a war he falsely claims has been unleashed against Russia.
Meanwhile, Tuesday, the United States announced it's providing Ukraine $1.2 billion in military aid. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. and its partners have worked hard to not just get Ukrainians more military aid, but training and maintenance experience as well.
My own estimation is that they have in place across all of those dimensions what they need to continue to be successful in regaining territory that was seized by force by Russia over the last 14 months.
And another journalist has died while covering the Russian invasion. French international news agency AFP said its Ukraine video coordinator was killed on Tuesday during a rocket attack near the eastern city of Bakhmut. The FBI on Tuesday revealed it has neutralized a malware network used for two decades by Russia to spy in 50 countries. Details now from VOA's chief national correspondent, Steve Herman, in Washington.
Government cybersecurity officials in the United States say the snake was defanged by the FBI, describing the malware as the most sophisticated cyber espionage tool in the arsenal of Russia's intelligence services. It wormed its way for many years, authorities say, into computer systems of governments, research facilities, banks, news media, and other organizations around the world. Computer security experts have known about the malware for years, but it was hard to detect in computer systems and network traffic. The U.S. Justice Department says an operation codenamed Medusa disabled the malware on compromised computers through the use of an FBI-created tool that issued commands causing the snake to overwrite its own vital components. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Pakistan is on edge after paramilitary forces arrested former Prime Minister Imran Khan on corruption charges on Tuesday. Since Khan's ouster last year, the country has been mired in political instability. And some fear that the chaos may grow worse as Khan supporters target their anger at the powerful military. VOA's Sarah Zaman has more from Islamabad.
an army commander's residence vandalized, military vehicles pelted with stones, angry protesters in the streets. Tensions are high in Pakistan after paramilitary forces took former Prime Minister Imran Khan into custody on corruption charges on Tuesday. Khan was at the High Court complex in Islamabad to seek a bail extension in a number of cases when Rangers personnel broke into the room where court officials were taking his biometric data. Paramilitary forces hauled Khan away without his wheelchair. The cricket star turned politician is recovering from a leg injury suffered in an assassination attempt last November. Soon after the arrest, demonstrations broke out across major Pakistani cities.
We were not even expecting that they would arrest Khan, such a great leader of Pakistan, such a dearly loved leader. We had not even thought that they would cross that red line. I personally feel that we have to come out in every street, every alley, every town.
Khan accuses Pakistan's powerful army and intelligence agency of being behind his political troubles and threats to his life. Khan's supporters back his allegations, despite denials from the military. In a remarkable show of anger, Khan's supporters in the eastern city of Lahore ransacked the house of the regional military corps commander.
These items are from my tax money. They were in a house that also belongs to us, so I have taken things out of what is my house.
As protesters and police clashed across Pakistan, reports of injuries emerged on both sides. Since his ouster, Khan has faced dozens of cases of alleged corruption, treason and terrorism. He denies the charges. The former prime minister was arrested in a corruption case on a warrant issued by the National Accountability Bureau, an autonomous anti-corruption body. Pakistan plunged into political chaos April last year when Khan was ousted in a parliamentary vote of no confidence less than 4 years into a five-year term. The arrest of the popular political leader has further raised fears that the nuclear-armed country of nearly 230 million people will plunge even further into chaos. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Islamabad.
Residents of Sudan's capital reported airstrikes overnight and sporadic gun battles Tuesday morning amid what they say is a surge in looting, with no sign of progress in ceasefire talks taking place in Saudi Arabia. The violence has accelerated a wave of people fleeing their homes. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the number of people internally displaced inside Sudan more than doubled in a week to more than 700,000. I spoke with Dr. Mohammed Issa, Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Assistant, or Association. Last time we spoke, there was no safe way for you to leave Khartoum, but you are now speaking to us from Saudi Arabia, but still providing support for Sudan, correct?
I got out through one of the ships that was arranged by the Royal Saudi Navy, and now I'm in Jeddah, in Saudi Arabia. The moment I got connection, I went back straight into operation in Sudan along with my colleagues in the United States. The situation is, you know, it's just overwhelming.
I understand there are real issues with the getting the supplies in safely to the places that they need to be, plus the power outages that are basically destroying medicines that need cold storage.
Oh, 100%. And this has been the issue, you know, since day one. These medications that cannot go 24 hours without electricity supply. Unfortunately, we lost a good amount of these medications. Number two is getting gasoline to run these generators to provide electricity is an issue. Now it's gasoline prices are went up to the roof. And the supplies that are coming from outside Sudan or are trying to sneak it to Khartoum state, it's an issue by itself. Because A, where are you going to take them through to sort of avoid all the areas of the conflicts of being attacked and whatnot? And B, how are you going to store them, especially if some of them needs to be in a continuous electricity supply? We lost a good amount of supplies.
What are some of the main things that you're trying to do? What's the overall situation?
Yeah, pretty much they remain the same, to be honest. We're still trying to arrange for medical supplies. We're still trying to stock the hospitals, trying to get some of the hospitals opening again to accommodate the injury. One of the issues that we're facing right now is the chronic medical problems. Let's say diabetes, high blood pressure, heart problems are becoming an issue right now. A And that's what our biggest fear right now is, those people who have not been injured, they're not going to make it because they can't access medical care because of their chronic problems. For instance, people on, you know, that need dialysis. There was a child that died the other day because his family couldn't get him to dialysis. And he's relying 100% on dialysis. People with any sort of organ transplant, they don't have access to the medications that are needed for transplant. And those medications are vital. You know, if you don't get it, you're pretty much the organ may fail and you may die from that. So that's another issue that we are facing right now and we're trying to tackle. And what we're trying to do is to set up all the hospitals at the border between Khartoum State and Zaire State so that they can accept injuries. And also we're aligning ambulances at the border between Khartoum State and Jazeera State. We're working with other medical relief organizations to get more supplies now to Sudan, since Port Sudan is operational. And the third issue is the huge amount of the refugees. There's thousands of people that crossed the border to Chad. So our organization is working with another medical relief organization to set up a camp there at the border with Chad, and also getting supplies there. And we're just working on the logistics now, getting a warehouse and whatnot, so that we can get going on the refugees who cross the border to Chad. And unfortunately, the continuous ceasefire announcement that we hear, it's just ridiculous. It's not happening. And, you know, the warring parties keep now saying, we allow this, we allow that for humanitarian needs, for humanitarian access. It's not happening. It's not happening. The fighting continues.
Dr. Mohamed Issa, Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, speaking to us from Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. Top Democratic and Republican lawmakers in the U.S. emerged frustrated and empty-handed after a tense meeting on Tuesday with President Joe Biden over the nation's debt limit. This as the U.S. stares down the possibility of defaulting on its financial obligations for the first time in history. Israel killed three Islamic Jihad commanders in Gaza, and at least 10 civilians, including several children, in surprise pre-dawn airstrikes on Tuesday, drawing threats of reprisals and warnings of a further escalation in fighting. And more than 5,500 people are still unaccounted for in an east area in East Democratic Republic of Congo, where floods killed more than 400 people last week. As shaken survivors wait for food aid, scores of bodies have been recovered from several villages since torrential rain caused landslides and flash floods. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A recently discovered asteroid called 2023 DW is creating quite a buzz on the internet. 2023 DW is described as being 50 meters in diameter and that it takes 271 days to orbit the sun. The asteroid is listed at the number one spot on the European Space Agency's asteroid risk list. ESA's list and one from NASA's Center for Near-Earth Object Studies show it to closely pass and possibly impact Earth at 2145 UTC on February 14th, Valentine's Day 2046. A tweet by NASA's Asteroid Watch says that as of now, there is very little risk of Earth impact and that it should be about 7.5 million kilometers away at the time. An email from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory also suggests that it's being monitored very closely and predictions will be updated once more data is gathered. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. As investigators try to discern the motive of the gunman who killed eight people at a Dallas-area mall over the weekend, agents have been reviewing social media accounts believed to be used by the gunman to post far-right extremist views, interest in white supremacy, and neo-Nazi leanings. This latest mass shooting comes as the U.S. grapples with the rising threat of domestic terrorism. I spoke with Megan Squire, Deputy Director for Data Analytics and Intelligence at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
It does seem that we're looking at more of these events happening. They're increasing both in frequency and in the vitriol, the volume of the rhetoric being espoused, the violence that groups and individuals are carrying out. The most recent instance in Allen, Texas, the shooter was motivated by a variety of white supremacist ideologies and did have ready access to multiple weapons and had been planning this event for quite some time. I think one of the things that's becoming more common, and we can see it in this case, is he didn't seem to have affiliation with any on-the-ground groups. He was mostly acting alone, but heavily influenced by folks online, so websites and content that he was reading online, but he was not part of any specific group. That pattern is becoming much more common.
Why do you think that is? Why are we seeing this rise in domestic terrorism incidents and still the activity of some of these more organized anti-government groups?
So we do still have quite a bit of activity being carried out, violent activity carried out by groups. We are also seeing a more diffuse set of actions being carried out by individuals who don't appear to be affiliated with any specific group. Both of those patterns are continuing. Basically, if you want to join a group, you can do that. If you want to act alone, you can do that as well. Different people, you know, different geographical regions or with different ideological systems will choose one or the other. In this case, we did see a single individual who was heavily influenced by things that he saw online carry out this particular shooting. I think both of those trends are concerning.
What about anti-Semitism?
Definitely, that is a major concern. And this shooter in Allen, Texas did also have some anti-Semitic beliefs. He seemed to come to those a little bit later than some of his other hateful beliefs, though. He was virulently misogynistic, lots of anti-women content, involuntary celibate type content on his postings. He later became more overtly racist and then eventually also anti-Semitic. That's not always the pattern that we see. And that is becoming concerningly more common. There's just sort of almost a meme aspect to anti-Semitism now, which is extremely unfortunate. It's images and jokes and jargon, just very online culture.
You've been seeing a rise in this anti-Semitic, neo-Nazi movements, anti-government militias, and you've been tracking these extremist groups across the country. Is there any explanation as to why this is taking on another level and creating probably one of the most significant times that we've seen such a risk of domestic terrorism?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of factors at play. So SPLC has been tracking hate and extremist groups for decades now. The numbers ebb and flow. There's different societal factors and so on. I think that everybody is kind of looking, though, now at almost like from a research point of view, what happened during the pandemic, what happened with the 2020 election, the sort of mood in the country, the increase in just surely the amount of firearms that people purchased during the pandemic, the change in social behavior, social relationships that happened during that time, people becoming more lonely, more isolated, consuming a lot more online content. So all of those things are kind of open research questions now. We're trying to gather the data, and that's part of our remit. It actually is to starting to collect those numbers and try to figure out exactly what is going on and what caused all of this.
How concerned is your organization about what we're seeing?
We're always concerned about any volume of hate and extremism, whether it's online, in person, all of the above. That's why it's our mission to track these bad actors and expose what we find using every tool in the toolbox, as we say. So yeah, this is unfortunately something that we're charged with every day.
I don't know if you can speak to this, but we're also seeing a trend toward this pro-Nazi, white supremacy sorts of extremists beyond the United States, across the world. Are you guys tracking any of that? Or is it all sort of related to what we're seeing here?
So mostly the SPLC focuses on domestic groups, so U.S.-based groups, but we do see quite a bit of back and forth. Sometimes we export from our country hateful beliefs, and sometimes we import them from other places. I think with, you know, the way the internet works, information is free and global. So we're seeing a lot of back and forth. And that extends to financing, extends to ideology, cultural artifacts, songs, and that sort of thing, videos. So yeah, it's a two-way street.
Megan Squire with the Southern Poverty Law Center. French bulldogs fit their big personalities in small packages. Their unique blend of energy and cuteness has made them the most popular dog in the United States. For VOA in Washington, Julia Rera has the story.
According to the American Kennel Club, there's a new favorite dog in the United States, the French Bulldog, dethroning the Labrador, which has been a longtime favorite.
A Frenchie is great for apartment living. They are not a noisy breed. They actually need moderate exercise, just a little bit of walking. and you're good to go.
French bulldogs have been around since the 1800s. Despite their name, they were originally bred in England and imported to France during the Industrial Revolution. Today, their adaptability for traveling and their playful nature make them ideal companions.
They're super cute, really relaxed and playful when you want them to be.
Oh, they're a really cool, chill dog, like relaxed dog, you know, very, very fun to have.
But there is a downside to the breed's new popularity. Their increasing visibility and price, which can exceed $6,000, has made them a target for thieves who steal them and sell them on the black market. In 2021, gunmen kidnapped two of Lady Gaga's French bulldogs and shot and seriously injured the person walking them. The singer offered a reward of $500,000 and was able to recover them.
My friend's got his bulldog stolen. Yeah, at gunpoint.
The American Kennel Club says owners should be careful.
We tell people all the time to be vigilant, to make sure you're not putting too much on social media about your dogs. Try walking them at times where it's more highly trafficked, so you don't want to do too early in the morning or too late at night.
Despite the potential headaches and even risks of owning any dog, experts say it's worth it.
What they provide is a feeling of social support, and they not only improve your mood, but they help you not to feel so alone, to give you company, interaction.
Knowing that, it's no surprise the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals notes that nearly one in five American households adopted a pet during the COVID lockdowns, and 90% of the new pets were dogs. For VOA News, Julia Riera, Washington.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. That's it for today's show. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Northern Syria is currently the home of some 10,000 former ISIS fighters, the largest concentration of terrorists in the world. About 5,000 of them are Syrians, 3,000 Iraqis, and 2,000 are foreign fighters from 60 countries outside of Syria and Iraq. Most of these men were captured by the Syrian Democratic Forces with support by the Coalition to Defeat ISIS in early 2019, as ISIS tried and failed to hold on to the town of Baghouz, its last foothold in Syria. Today, these men live in the Al-Hol detention camp on the outskirts of the town of the same name. Living with them in Al-Hol and another camp, the Raj facility, are their families, around 56,000 noncombatants, including young children, some of whom were born in the detention facilities. These people are waiting to be repatriated to their home countries. However, although the rate of repatriation has picked up over the past year or so, the home countries of these detainees are often unwilling or slow to take back their citizens. Those detainees who were allowed to return home were mostly women and children. While repatriation of women and children is important and urgent, the hard truth is that countries must also repatriate men and youth in detention and rehabilitation centers, said Ian Moss, the U.S. State Department's deputy coordinator for counterterrorism with responsibility for terrorist detention and countering violent extremism. We hear time and time again leaders say their domestic publics are opposed to repatriation. They argue that the fighters, if they are successfully prosecuted, could risk radicalizing prison populations. They also express concern that returnees who are unable to be prosecuted could plan future terrorist attacks or promote violence. There is indeed a risk of radicalization to violence and recidivism, but the alternative, a possible resurgence of ISIS, is worse. ISIS continues to look for new opportunities to replenish its ranks by trying to free these detained fighters, said Mr. Moss. If they escape, they will pose a threat not only to northeast Syria and the region, but to our homelands, he said. The best way to prevent this is to repatriate these individuals so they can be rehabilitated, reintegrated, and where appropriate, prosecuted. Reducing the populations in both the camps and detention centers not only make us more secure, but also makes the problem more manageable.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.